the nutrients that you need, potassium is something needed in very large quantities. You need 4,700 milligrams of potassium every single day. Now, what does that mean with food? It means that hardly anyone is getting their potassium because you would need 7 to 10 cups of vegetables every single day. Okay, so how many cups of vegetables do you consume in a given day? Maybe 5, maybe less, but I do it because I feel so much different. But here's the thing, we need 4 times as much potassium as we do sodium. Okay, most people consume 4 times as much sodium as they do potassium. They have a lot of fluid retention, so they both work together in relationship to fluids and hydration. But we need, if you look at vegetable content, it's always heavy on the potassium and very low in the sodium, okay? But if you're doing like chips and salty things, that's gonna throw this whole thing off. So what happens when you have low potassium is you get high blood pressure. Potassium is a physiological relaxer. It calms the nervous system. It actually softens the arteries. It actually can prevent strokes. It's very, very healthy. Healthy mineral. And so it can also prevent constipation. It also can prevent leg cramps. So it's involved in nerve conductivity and muscle contraction and relaxation. So with a problem with potassium, you can have a lot of cramps, tightness, and tension in your body, and you can also have a lot of electrical problems with your heart. Arrhythmias, atrial fib, that's all potassium deficiency because people don't consume enough. So let's pretend that you have high blood pressure and you have to take a diuretic. Thiazide. Well, what that does is it gets rid of fluid. Well, it also gets rid of potassium. So what happens when you take this diuretic to fix your high blood pressure, you lose more potassium, raising the blood pressure more. So now you need another medication. And then you're told to drink more water, which dilutes the electrolytes more, especially potassium, and your blood pressure goes higher because more water is not going to hydrate you. It's going to get rid of the electrolytes that you have, potassium specifically, and you don't get the hydration you once had. So the whole myth of drinking more water to hydrate you is not quite true. You need the minerals, specifically potassium. That's the one you need in the most amount. Like even magnesium, you need about 420 milligrams, but potassium, you need 4,700. Okay? Now, also, if you're salt sensitive, okay, especially with your blood pressure, what that really means is you're potassium deficient. The way to fix people that are salt sensitive is just increase the potassium and they'll do fine. So instead of restricting salt, why don't we just increase potassium? It's a better strategy because you need potassium for other things. 98% of all the potassium in your body is inside the cell, not outside the cell. So when you get tested from your blood or whatever testing you do, it's very difficult to test a potassium deficiency because it's all inside the cell. And so you might think you have normal levels, but you really don't because you never did an intracellular test for potassium, okay? The other interesting thing about potassium is it takes insulin to control and absorb potassium. If you don't have enough insulin, you can't pull potassium in the cells. So insulin regulates potassium. Now, how does that relate to a pre-diabetic, someone has insulin resistance, or a diabetic? Well, if they have insulin resistance, the cells are going to block insulin. So guess what's going to happen to the potassium? They're not going to have enough potassium. So a lot of times when you have a pre-diabetic or like even a diabetic state, they have a huge, huge deficiency of potassium. And one of the things I make sure that they do is greatly increase the vegetable content to increase the potassium to help balance this thing out, because they're going to have so many side effects from that. So if you actually add more potassium, you can decrease the need for insulin. So that's a really cool relationship. I just wanted to touch on the relationship between these two, these three items right here. And if you have blood pressure, start increasing your vegetables. And if you like this kind of information, if you like learning about nutrition, if you find it interesting, I have a health coaching training program that you might be interested in learning about, where we teach you a lot more about nutrition and how the body works. So if you want to apply to the scholarship that I have, click the link below, check it out, study it, and maybe you can be a health coach as well. Thanks for watching.
Okay. Greetings, Brother Roz. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Greetings to you too and to the callers and listeners.
Yeah, that was pretty good. Good video.
I thought it was really important. I would say the reason I think it was important was because most of us, including myself, don't really understand potassium and how important it really is. It's very, very powerful as far as flushing excess salt out of your system, which will facilitate balancing out your blood pressure by reducing the salt intake, which means that you're not going to retain as much fluid. That's why if you have a really hot, intense workout, some people actually sweat salt out of their pores. And once their skin dries, you know, the sweat's on the surface of your skin, it's wet. But once the sweat dries, you'll actually find mineralized salt on your skin. Some people go through that. I've been through that, especially when I was younger and just more intensely exercising and whatnot. You'll find that's the case. Say that again?
I know what you mean.
Yeah, so ultimately, I wanted to get into that for the reason of potassium, the fact that it softens the arteries. It helps prevent stroke by keeping, which stroke is the serious hardening of the arteries and eventually stopping of blood flow causing a hemorrhage. Also, the relationship to diabetes, I thought was very, very important. That's something I didn't know. I know about potassium and blood pressure, but I didn't know about the relationship to diabetes, and I thought that was really important so that anyone else that might have any sort of these weird spinoffs, because most times people who are diabetic tend to have blood pressure issues and vice versa. So I like the way he broke down the use of drugs for blood pressure and how it reduces the potassium and forces you to take other drugs, because I know people that has happened to. Mm. And if you can get the potassium levels high enough, the body will balance itself out as far as blood pressure. Another great thing that automatically works to balance the blood pressure, whether it's high or low, is cayenne pepper. That's one of the main reasons that Mexicans, one specific group, Mexicans, were studied to have some of the lowest incidence of heart attack in the world and blood pressure issues. And that was due to the fact that they use a lot of like jalapeno peppers and different peppers in their food. And that automatically will balance the blood flow. If it's too low, it'll bring it up to homeostasis. If it's too high, it'll bring it down to homeostasis. It's also the herb that you would use if someone has a heart attack. It's known very well to reverse heart attacks. If you get it to them within the first minutes of the heart attack, like in the tea form, like a tablespoon to like an 8-ounce glass of water, and you can maybe toss in some apple cider vinegar and have them drink that, and they'll be revived before the ambulance comes. And I even read, I believe it was in a book, that a natural healing book, that it's so effective at reversing the heart attack that the heart doesn't even show signs of having been through one. So the stress and the different stress markers that the heart muscle will show, that would be indicative, in some cases aren't even there. That's how successful it is at reversing the heart attack. So that's just something that I thought was important as far as potassium and blood pressure, because a lot of our people deal with that stuff all the time.
Yeah,
and
me
I think
right
it's
now.
Important. Go ahead, say it again.
I say me right now. I wish I did have a pepper to just.
Oh yeah, that's really good. Cayenne pepper is awesome. You could actually get it in pill form too. And I would say if you do take it in pill form, just take it on with after you've eaten something, because if you take it on an empty stomach, especially if you take it a really strong dose, like 500 milligrams, you're going to feel like it's going to feel slightly painful in the beginning. Not bad, but there's going to be like a dull pain. And then you're going to feel like a burst of heat that's going to radiate from your gut out. It's almost like you feel like there's an internal sun that's burning you up on the inside. And then after it settles out, you might even break out in a sweat. And then once it settles out, you'll be fine. But I've been through that a few times because I've taken it like that. And man, it can be intense. And the one time I took it on a not so full stomach, so I didn't really eat much, it was not a game. It was seriously not a game. So I would say if you take it, don't try not to take it in high doses. Take it in low doses, and you can always up it until you get to like what's comfortable for you. Also, strangely enough, dairy products like cow's milk actually counteract the intensity of the heat of pepper, including cayenne pepper. So if you ever eat anything that's intensely hot and it's burning your mouth and you want to dissipate that heat as quickly as possible, you can. I don't drink dairy products at all, but you can wash your mouth out with it, shake it out, shake your mouth out with it, and it'll actually dumb down that heat and mitigate it for you, so it's not as bad. So just another little tidbit there.
Oh yes. And that just doing this on a regular basis creates a little preventive maintenance. And I'm personally seeing the effects of it. But man, is it hard. Where we going?
It can be. What are you gonna say?
I say, what we going on this next? Oh
The
man, you
next
know
one
what?
is the most powerful anti-cancer nutrient.
Okay.
All right.
Talk about holistically, what are some of the options with cancer? What are some of the alternative therapies that you have seen be
Well, for me,
successful?
from a simple perspective, it's all about replenishing the minerals that have been lost. So utilizing multi-mineral forms, food state type things, ideally, although there are things like the Kintone has these injectables, although they can't sell them as injectables, hypotonic, hypertonic, isotonic forms of it's seawater. It's a fascinating thing if you read about Quinton, Quinton, Rene Quinton, I believe it was, the research that he did and what it's led to. But it's remineralizing that can help in so many cases, so many diseases. With cancer, I'd say the number one trace mineral, this is not to say I'm an isolationist, but I will acknowledge that selenium is critically important of all of the minerals that have been, basically debased from the soils. And if you increase selenium levels from a food-grown source, preferably, that is, we are designed to take food not from rocks, but the plants do that. They take it from the rocks and convert it into a form that we can assimilate. Now you can restore that which is lost, and that selenium, which is the most powerful and potent of anti-cancer, cancer prevention and reversal nutrients. It also works with the liver. It works with the endocrine system as well. A lot of people know I'm an expert in silver therapeutics, and they'll also ask and say, "Hey, Robert, what about silver, colloidal silver? I've talked, extensively about silver hydrosol and the qualities and properties." And because of its power to carry oxygen with it into the body, it is a powerful adjunct in cancer therapy. There were some tests conducted that showed that the silver in this way, at a nano size, could outperform these platinum-based drugs. Chemotherapeutic drugs with platinum that they use were very toxic and dangerous, but they had an impact on cancer cells. They utilized the silver in the nano realm and were able to achieve the same or better success with none of the toxicity, none of the danger. So I would say look to that as an adjunct as well in recovery. Also, we use as ho in homeopathy, sarcodes, or we take cancerous cells or tissue from someone with cancer, and we convert it via serial dilution and succussion into a safe form for ingestion, a homeopathic form, and that can also alert the immune system to target and work with the body. One other mineral I want to re recommend and reference here is silicon, and I think I mentioned it in another point of our interview, for vascular and connective tissue issues. This is for the connective tissue issue. Utilizing silica strengthens the integrity, the elasticity of the connective tissue. How does cancer metastasize? It utilizes it like enzymes that chew through the connective tissue. If you can strengthen it through nutrition, you make it less likely to near impossible for any aberrant cancer cells to metastasize, to grow out of our ability to retain them as our immune system is weakened due to all the things we talk about, toxicity, deficiency, And then there are emotional and spiritual issues as well that I don't want to overlook, but sometimes getting to the brass tacks physiology is something that people can grasp and get, okay, I can do that. I can do more selenium. I can do a little silver. I can do silica and find these good quality food-grown nutrients.
That's also part of my preventive maintenance, taking
Yes.
silver on a regular basis.
Without question. Actually, I just beat flu about maybe almost 2 weeks ago.
Say what?
That I beat a flu. I didn't get it, and I was able to successfully fight it off within about 24 to 48 hours. And I used pretty much, I used silver. I used Forthes oil. I put it in some tea, and I was drinking green and black tea together. I would put like 2 drops of the
all of oregano
oil. The Forthes oil in the tea, and I would sip on it throughout the day. I did that about 2-3 times, and I had silver, really, really strong silver. I made an extremely strong batch, and then I put also drops of 500 parts per million silver in that, and I took that to work, and I was tossing that up throughout the day. Hmm. And also I put hydrogen peroxide in my ear canal for about 10 minutes each ear, and I did that for both days straight, because flus and colds all start in the ear canal first. That's why you have what's known as the ENT, ear, nose, and throat doctor, a laryngologist. What they do is, what they discovered is, colds and flu enter the body through the ear canal first. It festers there and then travels down the ear into the sinuses, which is usually most people will start the sneezing process, and then into the throat, where most people will feel like the beginnings of a sore throat or throat irritation before the major symptoms kick in. So if you can kill the infection in the ear canal, it never gets the opportunity to fester and then travel down the nose and throat and eventually into the lungs to create the flu symptoms, as well as for a lot of people who suffer from the bronchital symptoms. So I was actually able to successfully fend that off with silver. I took heavy doses of silver for those few days, and I was taking it regularly before that. And then I also incorporated the Forthes oil in my tea. I had I took Emergency as well. I had that, which is really, really good. It's a effervescent version of vitamin C. I took about 2,000, which would be two packets, twice a day. So that's what I did, and I was able to kick it and not even fully develop a sickness. I didn't have, I just had the very, very beginning stages. I knocked it out, never actually got sick. My wife fought hers off pretty quickly, and my mother-in-law fought hers off really quickly as well, and they both used silver and a myriad of other things as well. So I just like that he discussed it in this video in reference to cancer therapy, which is something we've talked about quite a bit. I like that he talked about silica and also selenium. Selenium is one of the crystals that I carry with me every day to work. So it's interesting. And he said, of course, we don't process the rock version, which is what I carry for spiritual and metaphysical reasons, but it's the plant created version. So the plants can actually break down the rock form and pretty much create an organic version, which our bodies are able to process. And in so doing, one of the most powerful anti-cancer trace minerals, as you said. So I thought it was really great to put that information out there. Real short video, to the point, but just chock full of great information. And I love the way he discussed colloidal silver. He talked about hydrosol silver, which I've seen before. It's like in a nasal spray that you can spray up in the nostrils, and it'll coat the sinus cavity. So, of course, that's another good thing, too. You can inhale silver into your sinus cavity, and it'll actually bathe the inside of your nose and kill any infection that's festering in your sinus cavities as well.
Yeah,
that is a really, really good thing. Go ahead.
You put it in the vaporizer and let that. I'm currently fighting through to get rid of it. So this all of oregano is what I've been on and trying to stay hydrated.
I wish you the best in that valiant fight, too, because it's not a game. So hopefully you'll be able to get rid of it and it doesn't do anything serious to put you out of commission. So did you have anything else you wanted to say about that particular clip?
No, you took care of that pretty well.
Okay. Well, the next one I wanted to get into is from Financial Times, and it's entitled Social Networking and the Increasing Burden on Mental Health. Managing the effects of constant personal and professional use of social media is tricky. So
it is
basically, I'm not even going to go into it, but basically what it's talking about is the fact that the majority of people who work in different companies, corporations, you are coming into contact with or actually using social media on some level. And the fact that social media use is something that creates and facilitates mental illness. And as a result, they're trying to figure the balance between personal use, because a lot of people are addicted to their phones. So outside of the job, they're stuck to their phones. So if you have a job where you have to utilize social media as well, you're going to be facilitating that addiction because you have to use it on the job, and that'll be your excuse. Oh, I have to use it for work. So you're on Facebook or whatever the social media platform is. And then once you leave the job, you're furthering your addiction because now it's your time. You can do what you want. And that's what you have placed the top hierarchy of things of importance in your daily routine. So it's basically mitigating, decompressing from utilizing social media. And when you do that and you make that an active psychological practice, you don't get the anxiety or the fight or flight response from not looking at your phone for less than 5 minutes. Most people can't go 10 minutes without looking at their phone a number of times because it's an addiction. And a lot of people get cortisol production, which is the fight or flight hormone. And you get the symptoms of fight or flight, which would be the rapid, speedy heartbeat, adrenaline, and sometimes anxiety type of feeling that will be facilitated just by not having looked at the phone. And especially if you have a special tone that lets you know when you get a message or you get a post, and it's going bling, bling, and you're sitting there trying to do something else, and you just, you're dying to know, you're dying to get that dopamine rush. And the dopamine is basically what you're addicted to. So you want that dopamine rush of seeing, oh, this person actually, you know, liked my post, or they responded to something I wrote and it was in a positive way. So it makes me feel good. So you pick up that phone looking for what does the little red blurb say today? And that whole process is an addictive process. So when you have people that have to utilize these things on the job because it's a part of their daily routine, then that in and of itself can either create or highly facilitate a person who might be addicted to social media or their phones or apps on their phone. So it's really about just really being conscious of what kind of time and energy you're spending. They don't call it the attention economy for nothing. The more of your attention that they can hold for the longer amount of time, the more money they're generating. Literally, time is money. Your time is someone else's money. And if you use that time to your benefit, because the one thing to keep in mind, I don't care what you've been told, the most precious thing you have is your time and your energy. Because those are two things you will never get back. So whatever you dedicate to your time and energy to, make sure it's worthwhile, so you're not looking back and saying, well, cumulatively, I wasted so much time doing X, Y, Z when I could have been doing this instead, and this would have been much more productive, but I've lived that time out already. I can't go back and reclaim it and say, okay, well, I'm going to do things differently. You have to execute right the first time, every time. That's what I like about codification that Neil Fuller talked about, is executing it the same way, perfectly, every single time. And you can codify around your use of those things the same way. I'm only going to use it for this amount of time, and I'm going to ignore my phone for the next 3, 4, 5 hours. I do that all the time. It's just something I made a habit of before the addiction aspect was even a reality, as far as me hearing about it and further researching and studying it. I just was never liked to be controlled by anything, and that includes my phone. But not everyone's like me. So, Harry, you're going to say something, Jenna?
Yeah, that was, you said just about everything that could be said, but when we think about these things, it's, excuse me.
Take your time.
Social media done took and turned people into somebody else different. And I know we say this all the time, but even some of the, like say for instance, the people that you grew up with. And every now and again, you run across them. When they used to didn't say nothing at all, now they very talkative.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's for the people who have social media. Tell everything. When we grew up in an age where you never told nothing. So it's a program, just like you said. Sometimes I wonder if we're actually paying attention to what we're being programmed to do.
It was a workaround. That's how I've always described it. You had the overt taking of people's privacy via the Patriot Act. Everything's really intensified like in the worst way after 9/11. That's when it was all about just take as many rights from these people as possible, and we're going to scare the living crap out of them. Now that these buildings fell and all of this stuff happened, we're going to scare the crap out of them, and they're going to beg us to do whatever we got to do to make them feel safe. And that was the beginning of it. So as people were rebelling against that, they had to find a different way of obtaining the information that they could not take by force because people were rebelling openly. How you do that? You create a social media. You have this whole idea of connecting with old friends and family and maintaining connections and posting your photographs and looking at your growth over time, what you looked like when you first started your Facebook page versus 10 years later, what do you look like now? All of this crazy stuff was all presented as beneficent, wonderful. It's a way of connecting with people, networking. You'll be able to make connections even through your address book. So people who are connected to people who you have in your address book, you'll be able to know all this stuff. And everybody's like, oh, this is wonderful, wonderful. But the other part about it, it was free. You didn't have to go in there and pay for a subscription, but you were paying because now the information that they would have to send, you know, Alphabet Boys to your house to steal your garbage and look through your garbage for your papers and receipts and stuff. You just tell it now. I'm at McDonald's. It's 3:49 in the afternoon. I just came out the bathroom from McDonald's. I argued with somebody when I was washing my hands. Then after that, I went down to the mall on so-and-so street. And you just tell it everything. Things that they would have had to work for, everyone gives it away. And hey, it's all a part of social engineering. Like, oh, yeah, this is great. We're telling everything about ourselves. And if you're not on social media, your life doesn't exist. Nothing that you did ever really happened because there's no proof of it on social media.
Yeah.
I have certain friends. Go ahead.
That is, excuse me, that is very interesting point of view. I know we're going to dive a little deeper into that as we go on, but I want to switch directions real quick, which you was talking about the 9/11 and all of the laws beginning to be changed. We have constantly talked about the BIE, right? And down here at the D.C. March, and that's where it was at.
Which one?
Just here recently with the quote unquote Indian guy in the in the suspect.
Yes, if I remember correctly, it is in D.C. that happened.
Okay.
The confrontation, yes.
Now, do we remember what the BIE was described as?
They were described pretty much as Black Americans. Actually connected to the whole sovereignty movement. Your laws don't affect my reality. I'm not a part of your system. The people who say that type of stuff. The people who don't have licenses and all of that stuff, they ride around with their credentials in their vehicle and they have to carry these papers everywhere they go to defend themselves from on a legal level anytime they're stopped by the police for any reason. You had those folks. Then you had it was a myriad of Black people, but pretty much people who they saw as potential insurgents. That's the best way of describing it, because I always say to people, that's one thing you can, one word you can use and then explain the meaning of an insurgent to your child, because that is what we're looked at as an insurgent population, because of all the things that have happened to us that remain unresolved and we're still mistreated to this very second that I'm talking to you and continuing.
Yes.
That out of all of the groups in this country that would be most likely to facilitate, start, or be a part of a rebellion, we would be the ones that they would place at the top of the list, even above Native Americans. So that's where the whole BIE thing was trying to find these groups that were anti the establishment, what they would term as anti-government, but really people who love Black people, because the people who ended up going after were people who just actually loved their people and were willing to express it openly in ways that the government did not like and they felt needed to be addressed and dealt with, unlike the white identity extremists that are actually doing things to destroy this country and kill people and running over people with trucks and shooting folks and whatever else they're doing. So go ahead. If I don't know if I went
too far. No, I had just let you go for a minute. But
okay.
That was a good.
Take your time.
That was a good description. But what I was saying though is that, like you said, the white supremacists actually do stuff. Now, with it being on social media and all of that, it'll rouse some people up, don't you think?
Absolutely.
But what's gonna happen, because these suspects, they looking for race war. Now, when you go out and you antagonize, are we to be led to believe that that they didn't want no problems? They just felt that they could say whatever they wanted to say. Is that what we going to, or
what I'm finding is, ever since Trump came into office, these white supremacists and white power groups have been emboldened to facilitate attacking soft targets like I haven't seen in a while. As far as black women getting stabbed, black women getting sliced, just knocking out black women. I just posted a video today. Thankfully, there was no video footage of her getting knocked out, but she got knocked out after being terrorized in the vehicle with her friend. I think she's like 16 years old. And I think her mistake, as far as codification, was getting out of the vehicle. She should have stayed in the vehicle. Once she got out the vehicle, he felt he could, because he could physically reach out and touch her, at least in the car. He would have had to break the glass or attempt to open the door if she didn't lock it. But she physically got out the vehicle and asked him, you know, what did he say to her? Because he was calling her and her girlfriend all kind of racial slurs, anti-black racial slurs is how they describe it in the video. And she asked him, what did you say? Why did you say that to us? What are you saying to us? And then he just punched her in the face. And she, you know, she looked really bad. So this is like a regular thing now. Just attacking soft targets. You had the white guy who kicked a two-year-old toddler, just kicked him down right in front of his mother. You had the 51-year-old that cold cocked the 12-year-old, knocked her out. And the sister I'm talking about, she did hit her head on a concrete slab on the ground. It was like a bumper stop, and she could have died too. I know somebody who personally who killed someone by knocking them out. One hit a quitter, person hit the ground, hit the back of the head. You have what's known as the pons. That controls all of your involuntary functions as far as heartbeat and all of that. That's where the homosexual hit his head and he died on the spot. So, I mean, it's that easy to kill a person if the circumstances and timing is correct. And this is all black women, that this was black females, this was happening to in recent weeks. And it's just been ratcheting up ever since. And there's no stopping on the black males either. But the bottom line is that they're attacking soft targets. So it's about facilitating the race war. And then you have Donald Trump in office saying the most racist things ever. And they're moving ahead because the leader of the country is saying, this is the way it is. And this is what I'm about. He may not be saying it in overt ways. In some ways he is, but in other ways he's giving a secret conversation that they're picking up on and reacting to. It's a lot happening right now. So I think that the race war, they've been talking about that as long as I can remember. I've been hearing about that, but not with the intensity that I'm hearing about it now. And with the incidences to go along with the intensity, I'm just seeing stuff all over the place, whether it's the guy who got stabbed with the sword in New York City, the 65-year-old homeless guy that was actually about to get a job in an apartment, and he was just killed because the guy stalked him for like a block and a half after stalking two other black men that actually were alert, and that's what made him not attack them. The third black male, the elder black male, he wasn't alert. He was just focused on where he was going, and that was the opportunity that this guy took to kill him with a sword right there in the middle of Midtown Manhattan, broad daylight. So it's just really about the race war is one that they're trying to agitate and facilitate. But what white folks don't see is that black people don't function collectively like they do. So they're not going to get a race war. You might do something to, let's say, a gangbanger. His gang might come after you. And that's the closest thing you'll get to a race war. There's no wholesale black people coming together like, yeah, we got to get these white folks. That's not, we can't stand each other. We're quicker to kill each other than we would ever be to rally together to go get them.
Well, see, that's my question right there with the with the Hebrew Israelites, the message. I know it'll be a lot of people on social media, back to that again, talking about what they will do if this had to happen in front of them. And like you said, it ain't nobody coming together to do this. So when these little small, when these incidents happen, I see the same thing every time somebody pick up a phone. A lot of times I don't see no black men around either. So, like, where are these? Are these fairs? Are we, I don't know, man. It's just it go back to that code that everybody have, don't have, that I've been talking about as far as just be nice to each other. I mean, initially, right? I know it sounds crazy, but when you see something taken off the wrong way, you could give enough pause for somebody to get away, but we don't even do that no more.
A lot of us don't. Most of us, and again, it's psychosocial conditioning. You know how many things have happened in front of black people and black males were there, and all everybody did was pull out their phone and film? I remember there was a lady raped in public, and everybody pulled out their phones and taped the rape. No one intervened. No one called the police. They just started filming. And that is conditioning. That is conditioning. For you to sit there, watch a sexual violation of a female take place right in front of you, and instead of actually stopping the person, you are filming it almost like a porn voyeur. That is sick. But there's so many of us that are conditioned to not get involved in stuff in the first place. So we would prefer to film it because we're scared to get involved. A lot of us are like that. And I'm not saying that there isn't a reason. I think fear is healthy in a system of white supremacy because of all the things that have happened to us. But at the same time, you have to have set a limit for what you're going to tolerate. I have a low limit for tolerating things, whether it's personally done to me or done in my presence. That's just me, but everybody's not like me. Everyone's not like me, but that's just the way I function because I've done it as a teenager. I've done it as an adult. And if something happened, I would do it right now. So it's not something, again, I've never talked about doing something that I'm either not willing to do or haven't done myself. And when it comes to intervening on behalf of a black female, I've done that. And they were not related to me. In high school, we, you know, cleaned the dude's clock and left him laid out for assaulting, sexually assaulting, grabbing a girl that we went to school with. As a young adult, same thing. I didn't ask any questions. I saw what happened. I saw how everything started, and I just got busy. And a lot of times, all it takes is a black male just saying something, and they'll back down. But if they think a black woman's by herself, and nobody's going to come to her rescue, oh, she might get knocked clean out right in front of you. She might get spat on. She'll be called out of her name. They might drag her because they're thinking, hey, ain't nobody going to do nothing anyway. She a black woman. Like Malcolm X said, the most abused woman in this country is a black woman. The most disrespected female in this country is the black woman. Nobody gets treated and abused, killed on the level of black women. It just doesn't happen. And this history is long running. That is a fact. And the thing about it is, we have to come to a place where we get fed up of things happening that way and start making preemptive moves to thwart that. And a lot of times all it takes is just having a black male there. Just the presence of a black male a lot of times mitigates the potential for soft target attacks, because they don't want to deal with the black male. The only time they'll be willing to deal with a black male is if they got a knife, if they got a gun, or if it's more than one of them and they feel that they could take you because it's more of them than you. Those are the only circumstances where a black male would have to really think about it or worry about the potential of things going sideways. But for the vast majority of times, and even in situations where whites have weapons, just the male's presence is enough. They just don't want no smoke with a black male, and especially a black male in the protection of someone they care about and they love. That's what makes us most deadly. And that's really what it's about. It's just simply taking a stand where it's necessary. It's not about not being codified or being stupid or reckless. It's just about providing some semblance of protection so you're not getting bad news. It's just the way it is. And we just have to get to a place where we don't want to tolerate that. We just don't. I just came up in a different time. And a lot of the guys I grew up with, that's just how it was. We looked out for women. That's just how it was. I couldn't even put it to you no other way. I remember there was a dude who wanted to rob my mother. And I remember I got the message. It was the streets who told me about it. And they were like, nah, that's son's mom. You don't want no parts of that. You don't want to mess with her. He's not the one for that. And once he heard, he knew what it was. But he was scoping my mom's out on some robbery stuff. So it's just really about what are you willing to do? And it's not about you running around playing big and bad or anything. It's about when that moment comes, are you going to sit back, watch a black woman be assaulted or potentially killed? And sometimes it could just take you just saying, wait a minute, what you doing? And the person is I've seen it. I've seen it happen. Just an interjection. You don't even have to get physical. All you got to do is just, hey, what you talking about? Who you talking to like that? Sometimes that's all it takes. And the dude will just back down, or he might try to keep talking, but he'll talk to her and avoid you altogether. And when you get in the mix, you're like, yo, you talking to me now. You ain't talking to her no more. At that point, it's done. Because they don't want none. And that's one thing we've been trained not to see. It's the buck breaking we went through in the last program. It has been so successful. It's an epigenetic thing. It's just something we born doing. When they say something, you get scared. You don't say anything. You just let them do what they want. Nah, it can't always be like that. Because that's when you end up dead. You let people go too far, and they're going to go too far because you're letting them. You shut it down early, you got a better chance of mitigating things so that they don't get out of hand. And the other thing, get the heck up out of there. That's another thing. We like to wait around. What you waiting around for? Get the heck up out of there. Handle your business and get up out of there. That's another thing. Don't sit around waiting. Get up out of there.
You think
do what you got to do.
It might just be the new generation. But what we going to... That kind of make me want to go to Dr. Curry, but you want to do this $8,000 first?
Oh, yeah. Oh, this is crazy. Yes. And I remember when I read it, I was like, this is one that we got to talk about because it is just not a game. Let me pull it up right now. I'm on there. I think I might have passed it. Did I?
You talking about RT America?
Yeah, that's the one. Let me see.
I'm finna go ahead and play.
Yes, that's the one. Yeah, you can get it. Start at 22 seconds.
We'd be living hundreds of years. Our science was expected to be so far along that we'd have figured out how to extend our lifespans by large margins. But nope, we still haven't figured it out. And in fact, we're still doing some weird, stupid things in our quest for the Fountain of Youth, just like we have in previous centuries. Like this. A company called Ambrosia, as in the food of the gods that lets them live forever, is offering customers the service of filling their veins with the blood of young people in order to help rejuvenate their older bodies. For the low price of $8,000, you can get a blood transfusion of 1 liter of young people blood, or for $12,000, you can get 2 liters. Ambrosia has opened up clinics in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Tampa, Omaha, and Houston. They're already infusing people and have done so over 100 times. And they say that now they have a wait list, despite there being very little evidence that it does anything. There have been researchers that have studied the effects of young plasma transfusions who say they've actually seen cognitive boons in older participants who received young plasma, including an improved sense of self and recognition of one's place in the world. Ambrosia said they did a clinical trial to prove the procedure's safety too, but they have yet to publish the results. And according to a report from Business Insider, some of the medical researchers whose work Ambrosia references dispute the analysis of their work. They say that not only is Ambrosia's claims sketchy at best, they're downright dangerous. They point out that even though transfusions are generally safe and can save lives, they always pose risks of health complications that could come later in life, like graft versus host disease, where the transfused blood cells end up attacking the person's own cells. They say there's just not enough evidence yet to support doing something as radical as opening up clinics and giving perfectly healthy people blood transfusions. But since the FDA has approved transfusions, Ambrosia's allowed to go ahead and do it anyway. And if you're rich, you can line up for some of that delicious young blood yourself. Personally, I have other plans for my longevity. Live my best life until my body's about to crap out and then lop off my head and cryogenically freeze it. I mean, seriously, what's wrong with these people? Blood transfusions? That's so 17th century.
What you're seeing there is the corporatization of vampirism. And I found it fascinating because we talked about this. Like, say it again. Fantastic Voyage, yeah. And we talked about this, like, this exact subject, like, 2 years ago, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And they had an article where they were taking plasma and stem cells. Plasma basically has stem cells in it from young mice, transferring it to old mice, and found that the old mice lived twice as long and that it did actually reverse and rejuvenate them, just like she said. The difference here is that instead of plasma, they're taking the entire blood cell and doing a blood transfusion, which as she did state, could be very dangerous because the body could reject it. But what they're trying to do, and I think the company just hasn't dealt with the science well enough to actually know what they're doing, is they're trying to deal with the plasma that carries the stem cells and something known as telomeres. Telomeres are DNA strands, and as the body gets older and as it ages, the telomeres start to shrink and fray, and that will show up as aging in the body and in the organs and things of that nature. So if you can replace the old telomeres with young telomeres, which is what they found with, even when they started to do tests using human trials, they found that the body was rejuvenated because young people's blood plasma carries an abundance of these stem cells and these telomeres, which is indicative of youth. As you get older, the body chemistry changes, so those cells start to deteriorate and you go through the actual aging process. But if you can get those telomeres and those stem cells from the plasma of a young human being, then it can actually work wonders on your physical person and your organs, especially Black people, because you have to incorporate the melanin aspect, which is a whole nother thing to deal with. But that's what you're seeing here is essentially the corporatization of vampirism. And my question was, along with a lot of people in the comment area, is where are they getting this blood from? What young people? Because young people don't do blood transfusions unless there's a medical reason for it. So where are they getting it from?
Right.
Are these people who died?
Organ.
Are they killing them themselves? Are they stealing their organs? And then, of course, they're draining the blood and saying, okay, well, yeah, we got the blood, too. We got about, 8 liters? That's how much is in the human body. So we got about 8 liters here. And we got the organs of a young person. Like, where are they getting these things? That's the question. And I don't know anyone who has an answer for that. But I think it would be interesting if they were able to do, like, an investigative research on that. I'm sure the answers will be quite stunning.
Man.
So... But go ahead. What are you going to say? I found this fascinating.
I agree with you 100%. I hadn't even thought about that first. It was, I went straight to Fantastic Voyage. Live long Absolutely. Enough to live forever. I see them doing that. But yeah, where's all of these bodies and stuff that's, that they're taking this from?
Absolutely.
That is
That's
a
question.
Great question.
And these are young people, so these are teenagers. So what teenager is going to run around and say, yeah, I would love to give blood? I don't know. And I don't know. None of my boys ever were like, yeah, I'm going to go to the Red Cross today and give a couple pints. Never heard that in my life. I don't even think they take blood from teenagers. My mother used to give blood off and on, and I used to tell her not to do it, but she worked for the taxation department. They used to come right to her department and do their thing, and she was cool with that on a couple of occasions. I was just like, listen, I don't think that's the greatest thing for you to be doing. I mean, she stopped eventually, but she did it. And I've never seen them take blood from young people. So, that is the question. Where are they getting it from?
Yeah, that is a... That's a wonderful question, man. And it also made me think of medical apartheid, too. Just it's been so many different times in history where we have been sampled and just all kind of stuff. So, you know, taking pieces here, taking pieces there, just experimenting on us. It's,
exactly.
I would have came to that question, but yeah, I hadn't even thought of it yet.
That was the first thing that came to my mind is where are they getting this from? I was like, where's the supply coming from? Because you have to have a supply in order to have a waiting list. Where's your abundant supply of fresh teenage blood coming from?
Probably.
That sounds so crazy to even be saying, but it's the main question.
Do we have a caller?
Hello.
I think we do.
Greetings. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you? I called and came in late, but I heard the thing about teenage blood. They have blood drives at colleges all the time. Several a year.
Interesting.
I get teenage blood. That's what they get. I mean, if that's because I think legally you have to be at least 17. But yeah, they have blood drives at colleges all the time. All the time. Yep.
Now that makes sense.
All
so you think they're getting enough? You think they'll be do a lot of students participate where they'll be getting enough to have like a supply that they can use as far as having clients upon clients? Like basically, you have to be affluent or upper middle class to be able to afford it because it's $8,000 for 1 liter and $12,000 for 2 liters.
Well, I think
they have. When I went to a black school, I have to be honest. I don't remember them being as many as at a white school.
That makes sense.
But they have them all the time. They like you said, they have them on jobs all the time. And certain jobs, like when I lived in Ohio, I worked at Victoria's Secret in the call center. A lot of young people working have that type of job because young ladies they want the clothes, the fashion, blah blah blah. A young guy will probably meet a young girl because they all work there, blah, blah, blah. But, yeah, I mean, you get it from schools. And if you have certain schools, they may have a blood drive. Like if they, maybe like a white school with seniors, because like I said, you have to be at least 17. They'll have blood drives or something happens to one of their friends, then there'll be spikes. You know, like all these mass shootings, something happens, there's usually a spike then. You know, these disasters, there's a spike. So the spikes happen from time to time, I'm sure, with the blood supply.
Now, isn't that the blood drives and stuff that be at the colleges? Excuse me. Isn't those for, like, the Red Cross and places that give the blood away when somebody's injured?
Well, yeah, usually would there be, like, a local... Like every city, yeah, they have the Red Cross, but usually a big city, they have their own blood bank,
right.
Those, and then I know in the poor communities, you always see the plasma center, which isn't the same, but you see those because you can sell your plasma.
Right.
They have those in poor communities, so you see that. So, yeah, people, and, if something happened, or like usually even at, they have some other event like a fair or a parade or the Red Cross or whoever, they show up too. You know, they don't miss a beat. You know, if they can come, they're going to show up and try to get what they can get.
I see.
But in terms of paying for it, usually, what some people do that I've heard, like if they know they're going to have surgery, they'll try to donate their own blood. So it's there for the surgery. Now, something might happen with that. Because if they know they're going to have the surgery, they'll, again, not donate, but, have some reserves so that when they have the surgery, they can put their own blood back into them. Now, something funny may be happening with that.
Now, the people excuse me for interjecting, but the people I know that do that, like have their own blood, a lot of them tend to be affluent folks and white folks. Most other folks tend to get blood that's donated, and then they also, and I remember seeing this a couple of years ago, there was an article talking about specifically Chicago and how they tend to use artificial blood on gunshot victims
And black people do not respond well to artificial blood. And in the overwhelming majority of cases, they die.
And yeah, I can understand that because we're usually type O, which is the universal donor, but not the recipient. We're very particular. So yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, they said that our bodies do not respond well to it. And that was one of the ways that the organ trafficking was being fueled, was by the violence, because you have these people dying in the hospital at record numbers. And we have more than enough stories that I'm stealing organs of people that have died, especially young people. And our organs are the most sought after because of the melanin. We have the highest quality organs of any group on the planet. So the demand for organs from black people specifically is exponential. It is exponential. Even in China, they had a couple that had adopted an African female child. I think she was 6 years old. And within a week of her arrival in China, she magically ended up dead. And they said that they were taking her organs. And in China, there's the organ trade in China is like a genocide. You have certain groups that the government doesn't like, and a lot of them, they have jails. And these particular groups, they're taking them right out to jail and just killing them and stealing their organs. There's documentaries on YouTube that'll blow your mind. And they tend to take a lot of organs from African people. So
yeah,
it's something to really think about. But go ahead, what are you going to say?
I said, I can believe that. I just came in on the part about the blood. So I was like, where is it? I had to call in. I don't know. Something's wrong with the streaming. I don't know where I can go. So I had to call.
Thank you for letting me know. I didn't.
I mean, it could be fixed now, but when I got there, they had that music that's always playing. Dun, 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 you know, whatever that is.
Oh, okay.
Okay, thank you. But we,
I don't know the music, but you know, the beat, the music that's always playing.
Yeah, the line music, okay.
But, what was, excuse me. What was next on the list, Roz?
Oh, the next thing, I think those are all of the health-related ones. The next one I wanted to get into, let me go through these, because there's a couple dealing with codification and whatnot. Oh, there's one I wanted to get into. Oh, this one's from Atlanta Black Star, and I found this to be interesting. It was in the news, and it says, new program will pay Israeli citizens nearly $9,000 to hunt and capture African migrants for deportation. I find this interesting because they're basically deputizing their population. And I'm pretty sure they got that from America, because America used to deputize its population as slave catchers and things of that nature. So it says here, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but part of it. Israel is offering its citizens cold, hard cash to enlist in a controversial new program aimed at deporting a large portion of its African asylum and refugee population. Under the nation's Population and Immigration Authority, civilians would become so-called, quote-unquote, immigration inspectors, tasked with carrying out enforcement tasks against illegal aliens and their employers, unquote. For the government's immigration ministry, Newsweek reported, the ministry has offered, quote-unquote, appropriate pay and upwards of $8,600 in bonuses just to sweeten the deal. Their goal, to hire at least 100 inspectors by March 2018. A notice posted by the ministry last week stated that 70 inspectors will be brought on for a two-month period to carry out the aforementioned task, as well as to locate, detain, and monitor, unquote, illegal individuals when necessary. Moreover, the ministry said it'd like to hire 40 people to aid in conducting, quote-unquote, comprehensive questioning and investigation of asylum seekers. The news comes a week after the Israeli government announced the Assisted Voluntary Return Program, which offers to pay thousands of African migrants and asylum seekers living in the country illegally to return to their native countries. Undocumented persons have until the end of March to take advantage of the program or risk being jailed. I'll stop there. So they're literally going to have their population hunting. That's how they describe it, hunting and capturing. And the way Israelis like to kill people, the way they like to shoot people, and they revel in shooting children, like even Israeli soldiers, like they'll high five each other when they take down like a 7-year-old throwing a rock. So I could see a lot of black people being killed because their lives aren't worth anything in Israel, like they're not worth anything here. And the lack of value on African life is so global in scope that I could see a lot of people being killed, quote unquote, accidentally, or not even accidentally, because like I said, Israelis that are into that tend to rebel in that behavior. Say it again.
It's a job now.
Yeah. I mean, listen to the description. It sounds like a slave camp. It sounds like you know, you have runaway slaves and we need these militiamen to go catch them. So they put up a posting, you know, Negro age so-and-so, this is what they look like, $3,500 if you can catch them dead or alive. Like, that's what it sounds like to me. There's just a wordplay, to capture and hunt. What? This sounds like a safari. So they're going to have safari hunting of black people pretty much in Israel, and they're going to be paid nearly $9,000.
Now, is the U.S. going to go in? Is the U.S. going to go in and help when these Africans start killing these Israelis for trying to hunt them?
Well, like I said, Israel, they are renowned for their military game as far as, like, their ability to their
viciousness.
They're vicious. Their military strategy. They are just some heartless folks. So if any Africans try to give them anything, we see what they do to the Palestinians. Now remember, these people are mostly African from Sudan and from other countries. So these people are what Dr. Wilson would call crystal black. So you know that they're gonna really go in on them, because we know as far as the color hierarchy, the darker you are, the worse abuse you're going to get. So if any of those Africans act up, they'll shoot them and not wouldn't think twice about it. Israel is not a game when it comes to, like, just killing people arbitrarily and committing atrocities against people. They are just notorious for that. So, yeah, they're going to have a program to hunt and capture African migrants for deportation, paying close to $9,000. Wow. Mm-hmm. I thought that was quite telling in the system of white supremacy. And like we talked about, this race war, see, that's it right there, codified, paid for by the government, sanctioned by the government in Israel. The next one is from Face to Face Africa. And this one is U.S. plans to check 5-year social media history of applicants before issuing visas. So this just goes into them again. They're going to dig into your history. And of course, it's going to be mostly people coming from black countries and black people that are going to be subjected to this. But I wonder what would happen if the same was in reverse, because the vast majority of those sick white people that go to other people's countries to rape children and do all the crazy stuff that they do to people in their own countries, disrespecting them, calling them nigger and all kind of stuff. I wonder what would happen if those countries did a 5-year background, social media background check on them. You're going to find white supremacists talking about, you know, I hate black people, posing with guns, talking about a race war. I bet you'll find a lot of those people who are traveling, yeah, or they're going to have questionable child pornography content in their social media history.
But you mentioned
that comes
it
out
though.
All the time. Go ahead.
You mentioned it though. Under the system of white supremacy, they don't have to answer those questions.
I know. That's what I was saying. What if these other countries choose to do the same in reverse to America, especially now that David so eloquently talked about earlier today with Brother Scotty, peace to you, Brother Scotty, the untied states of America is rolling. Things are going to happen, and the 50 states that you're used to are not going to exist anymore. And some of those states are going to end up becoming their own territory. So imagine Americans wanting to travel to other people's countries, and they're being questioned about their social media history, because America is already on the decline. America is modern-day Rome, and it's collapsing, and it's collapsing rapidly. That's why we're seeing all of these incidents and all of these things happening. These are all the death throes of an empire that is on just the path of complete and utter destruction. And when we went into there was a great video that compared America to Rome, and literally we are at the exact stages that Rome was at when the visible empire falling apart was coming into play. So we're going to start to see the physical overt signs soon. I don't know how soon. It could happen overnight, or it could happen in the next few months. It could happen within the next year. But we're going to start to see overt signs that the economy is collapsing and the empire is collapsing. And when you start to see that, it's going to be too late for a lot of people. But yeah, this is, go ahead, what are you going to say?
No, just saying, we was talking about this earlier on in the program, doing this study doing this studying and going back and seeing history replay itself. Why wouldn't we make a better decision for it? Like you just said, we can go back and see the exact time frame.
Yes.
What the exact events during a particular time frame, I should say.
Some of us can make a better decision. Right now, some of us not. With everything stopping with the government shutdown, you're seeing the stoppage of what's known as bread and circus. The bread is stopped. Nobody's getting their welfare check. Nobody's going to be getting their tax refunds. This is stuff everyone's waiting for to survive and to be able to, you know, hold themselves down for the first half of the year financially. So a lot of people who depend on that, the bread's not there, literally. And you have now essential departments that protect the country from terror attacks, things like that, that are not working. Matter of fact, last week they said that there was a threat on the president's life and there weren't enough Secret Service working for him because of the government shutdown. So there wasn't enough protection for him and he could have gotten himself put in a life or death situation. So this could actually be the catalyst that starts everything off, because with everybody being laid off with the shutdown, as far as not getting paid, a lot of people are calling out regularly. Record numbers of TSA people are calling out, which means another 9/11 could happen right now. Because there's not enough people in the TSA checking people before they get on planes. So what if something takes place during this government shutdown that facilitates martial law now? And once martial law happens, we're not going back the opposite way. It's all just going to get worse from there. So this is a ripe period for like something really catastrophic to happen and set off everything that we've been predicting for like the last 8 years or more, minimum. Like real, this is really something to think about. It's not about a wall. A lot of people are fooled by thinking it's about a stupid wall. No, this could be the setup. And all it'll take is for one event. Either somebody do some 9/11 type stuff, or they blow up something, or they do some sort of military assault, or just a lone wolf who does something really ridiculous. And then bang, everything goes into martial law, shut down, and everything just starts to snowball from there. So it's really something to think about. Just be wary. And really just focus on preparing as best you can. That's what I would say.
Yeah,
but ultimately, go ahead. What are you going to say?
This shutdown crazy. And they, like you were saying, the TSA people being asked to work freely. Well, here in a little bit, if they don't get it corrected, they're going to have to do that during the Super Bowl. In one of the busiest airports in America.
You are correct.
With people not really caring what's going on. I ain't got paid in 2 months. Man, it's like you said, it's the seemed like a perfect setup.
Absolutely. Matter of fact, let me just take care of this too. You all are now listening to Real Life, the radio show with myself, Ross, and my co-host, Jenna Kepra, on Foundational Radio via Black Talk Radio Network. If you do wish to call in to ask a question or make a comment, please give us a call at 704-802-50. Did I have it right? 704-802-5056. Again, that's 704-802-5056 and press ** if you wish to ask a question or make a comment. And please watch your background noise. Thank you very much. We just want to take care of that. We just passed the hour. I just noticed that.
Yeah, thank you.
No, no problem, man. I just wanted to make sure we got that out there.
Over the mic.
No problem. So the next one is very interesting. This is from face2faceafrica.com. It says, after years of unsuccessful attempts at legislation, lynching is finally a federal crime. So this one's really, really interesting. So I'm just going to read the blurb. The news that lynching has been made a crime in America in 2018 got many people by surprise as they wondered why it took so long for this to be achieved. The bill was introduced by three black senators, Senators Kamala Harris of California, Cory Booker of New Jersey, and Tim Scott of South Carolina. So basically, it took forever, but now to lynch someone in this country is a federal crime. And they, I had the nerve to ask in America, in the system of white supremacy, why it took so long for this to become a legal win. Are they serious?
You can't make that a crime. That's a pastime.
Well, yeah, but also they're still lynching people to this day. You still got people being found, black people being found in trees. They're finding ways of calling it suicide.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm just answering your question. You saying in the system of white supremacy, I'm saying yes, that's a pastime. How you make that a crime? That's how they looking at that.
But that's what I'm saying. That's why I said, are they serious when they ask that question? Like, they can't be serious.
They are serious.
Like, come on, like this, like you said, it's like baseball and apple pie. That's American pastime, killing black people and creating what they call strange fruit. But it's finally a federal crime. This is 2018 that this was done. So, man, we've come a pretty long way, but we have so much further to go. It's ridiculous. The next one that I found that was quite interesting was this one's from undark.org, is the psychology of deadly force ready for the courts. And I found this to be quite telling because they're really giving pause for thought around the concept of deadly force and police officers using the excuse that they were scared and thought their life was in danger. And this was from actual mental health practitioners who actually go through it. And they have a interesting perspective on reality versus what is touted in the courts and what people have been conditioned to believe about deadly force and the physiology of it and the psychology of it. So I wanted to kind of get into that because this seems to be leading in an interesting direction. So I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm just going to read probably the very beginning of it, just because I think they touch on the things that are important at that time. There's a whole lot more in the article. You can get it on BTR Community in the thread for tonight's show in Real Life, the radio show. So this one says, on October 2nd, 2018, police psychologist Lawrence Miller took the stand to testify in the defense of Jason Van Dyke, a white police officer who shot Laquan McDonald, the black teenager from Chicago's West Side in 2014. The facts of the case didn't look good for Van Dyke, a 13-year veteran of the Chicago Police Department. He had shot McDonald 16 times within seconds of exiting his squad car. Though McDonald was holding a knife he had reportedly used to damage a patrol vehicle, the 17-year-old was shot while walking away from cops in the middle of the street. None of these events were in dispute. The shooting had been captured by another police vehicle's dashboard camera, and Van Dyke was charged with first-degree murder, 16 counts of aggravated battery with a firearm, and one count of official misconduct. The 67-year-old Miller, who lives in Boca Raton, Florida, was there not to argue about external events. Instead, he asked jurors to focus on Van Dyke's perception of the shooting. With the lights dim in the crowded courtroom, Miller presented a slideshow titled The Neuropsychology of Deadly Force Encounters. In the life and death situations, he explained the body stress response can distort cognition, perception, and memory. For police officers, this can lead to a phenomenon he referred to as quote-unquote deadly force mindset, where the officer, flooded with neurotransmitters and hormones that ensure survival of the moment, feels his or her only option is to kill or be killed. Van Dyke, Miller argues, should be found not guilty of the charges against him. Jurors scribbled notes throughout Miller's testimony. The use of psychologists in courtrooms is nothing new, of course, and defense attorneys and prosecutors alike have long relied on expert testimony to help divine the complex soup of chemical hormones and electrical impulses that drive human behavior. But the use of psychology in the defense of police officer shootings is less common, in part because so few officers ever end up on trial. Only 96 officers in America have been arrested for murder or manslaughter on an on-duty shooting since 2005, according to Bowling Green State University criminologist Philip Stinson. And such cases rarely make it to a courtroom, but when they do, and some experts suggest it's likely to become more common with the proliferation of cameras documenting police suspect interaction, testimony on the unique and stressful psychological tableau of police work has become a staple for the defense. And yet some psychologists argue that while the biology of stress is well established, its connection to deadly force is far less clear. While officers can experience cognitive and perceptual impairments like tunnel vision and dissociation, during deadly encounters, researchers ultimately know very little about what role they play in the decision to use deadly force. In the absence of rigorous science, psychologists are dubious of using neurobiology of stress in defense of police officers who kill. The defense used what seems to be an exculpatory argument, not actual data, to say, quote, you shouldn't be responsible because this is the level of stress on the job, unquote, said psychologist Philip Atiba Goff, a professor at the City University of New York's John Jay College of Criminal Justice and co-founder and president of the Center for Policing Equity, a think tank that studies racial disparities in criminal justice policy. Quote, this is a bad area for science to be in, unquote. On October 5th, jurors in Chicago ultimately found Van Dyke guilty of 16 counts of aggravated battery with a firearm and second-degree murder. The sentencing date is pending while Van Dyke's attorneys were still angling last week for a new trial. The judge denied those motions. In a phone interview after the original trial, Miller suggested that his testimony may have at least partly prompted the jury to deliver a verdict of second-degree rather than first-degree murder. That's a lesser charge and one that would seem to suggest legal experts say the jurors believe that Van Dyke felt himself to be in danger, even if his reaction was unreasonable. So,
yeah, and there's a lot more to that article. It continues on.
That's quite long. I don't want to read the whole thing.
Words,
but
like,
go ahead. What are you gonna say?
Just a bucket of words, like what Gus be saying. They said all of that just to excuse the fact that they want to be able to murder us. Like they want it to be legal. Just like the new lynching is illegal now. You know,
it's just finding legal loopholes, because the truth is, you cannot with any. Just common sense logic say that a person, even if they have a knife in their hand, you have a gun, their feet tens of feet away from you, and they're actually walking away from you. So the knife is in their hand, even if they have it, but they're facing the opposite direction. What threat are they posing?
Yeah, we
because
didn't...
in the article, they talked about, and I'm not going to read it, but they talked about the fact that Officer Van Dyke, they actually had him on his police radio on the way to the location. He had heard that McDonald had attacked the police car. I think he had sliced the tires or something, stabbed the tires. And he said before he got there, why didn't they just shoot him already if he's such a threat? He said, I think we're going to have to shoot this guy. I think we're going to have to kill him. So they actually have him recorded saying that on the way to the place before he even saw what was happening.
Yeah, that's
so before he got there, his intention was, I'm going to shoot this guy.
That's premeditated, though.
And he still got
off.
Go ahead.
That's premeditated murder, though, isn't it?
Oh, yes, premeditated. It should be. But because, like you said, the legal codification of killing black people, then it's not interpreted that way. Now, if that was a black officer that killed a white person, a white teenager, it would have been exactly applied that way. And we've seen that 1,000 times. Like, not 1,000 times, because black people don't kill white people that often, but just about every time a black officer's killed a white person, they have the book thrown at them.
Look, see, that takes me right back to that question I asked earlier in the show. With the routiness showed by the Hebrew Israelites at that little confrontation, it's always somebody who follows that kind of little wave and go out and be doing that. And they're going to mess around and get beat down, if not murdered.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, is that even smart, especially with the BIE thing? Because I think the only thing that they're going to do is continue to evolve it, putting staples of names. Well, I guess I shouldn't say that. Well, putting specific groups in as an identifier.
Oh, without question.
And I think that may be what they've done this past week.
Oh, yeah, because the thing is, like, I grew up seeing Hebrew Israelites all my life in New York. In Brooklyn, it was just a regular thing, especially when you went downtown. They would have their stands and they would have their microphone, and they'd just be berating the people on the sidewalk. Usually they get into arguments with white Christians, calling them devils and sons of Esau and all kinds of other names and stuff. And then it would also get into arguments with black people who did not believe in their interpretation of the biblical narrative. And I've seen them get physical with black people a lot. I've seen them threaten black people a lot. I've seen them threaten white people as well. But I've seen the most aggression I've seen Hebrew Israelites had was towards other black people. And depending on what their religious affiliation was, their attitude would be more intense depending on what religious background the person had. So to me, I don't know if they would be looked at as a black identity extremist, because I haven't really seen Hebrew Israelites that are against the establishment as far as them speaking out against that. Their entire perception and approach to everything is biblical, and it's based on their narrative of who the 12 tribes are and all of the different things that they carry as their ideology. So I couldn't really see them being a threat in the way in which they would be classified as BIE, because like I said, I've seen their negative attention focused on other black people. And as a result, why would the government focus on them? Because they're not focused on white people or the government. Mm. It's like slaves fighting at the bottom of the ship. They believe they're Hebrew. Anybody who doesn't believe like they believe, they have no respect for them, pretty much. So that's helping the white narrative, because that's just creating further infighting amongst other black people around ideological tribalism. So to me, when it comes to their approach, whites are winning by leaving them alone, and will continue to win by leaving them alone rather than attacking them. Now, if you're looking at other groups that speak out against abuse from the government, speak out about racism, white supremacy, or do things to try and fight those things in any form of fashion, legally, whatever the case may be, those are the ones they're worried about. The ones who own weapons legally, who talk about their willingness to use them to protect themselves and their community, those are the ones they're looking at. The ones who are all about their sovereignty and the Moorish paradigm of, you know, using their laws against them, the UCC codes and all the other things that they interpret in order to say, I'm not a part of your system, and this is why. And they got 1,000 papers with all of their information that they have, and they taught these legal jargon at the cops when they get pulled over. Those are the folks they're looking at. Those are the folks that tend to be on that list. Then you have some of them with the Aboriginal thing, too. That's a whole other aspect of it, because some of the BIE people have come across with that, and then other ones have been labeled that way by their association with Africa. So it all depends. But if they feel that you are a threat to the status quo and you're a threat to the way that groups of other non-white people are thinking about the system and how to deal with the system, then you're going to be a focus as far as that's concerned. Mm.
Answers my question. We can go on to the next one.
Okay. So the next one actually, let me see, play the one, I think the last one is called Being Black by Jane Elliott. Yeah, that was really short. I think it's like 30 seconds, but it's a profound 30 seconds. And you can tell them what you see, but I want them to hear it.
All right. It's just loading up. I don't know what's wrong with it.
Okay. It's super short, too. Excuse me. Did you click on the link, or is the video, like, on in the thread? Because I could see the video in the thread on my side. But the link is there, too.
I'm in the thread.
Okay.
So let me just do this. It ain't letting me go to the link.
Oh, it's not? It's okay. Giving you like an error?
Yeah.
Okay, well, you know what? We're just going to go ahead and get into this anyway. I'll just explain it. So this is a like 30-second video, if that long, of Jane Elliott. She's a famous white...
white person.
Oh, okay, got it.
All
right. I want every white person in this room who would be happy to be treated as this society in general treats our citizens, our black citizens. If you, as a white person, would be happy to receive the same treatment that our black citizens do in this society, please stand. You didn't understand the directions. If you white folks want to be treated the way blacks are in this society, stand. Nobody's standing here. That says very plainly that you know what's happening. You know you don't want it for you. I want to know why you're so willing to accept it or to allow it to happen for others.
Excuse me.
Short but profound. What she was in was a room full of, looked like college students, and these were all ages. You had elder white folks and young white folks all in the same mix. I think there might have been one or two black people in the room, if any. It was like 99% white people.
Right.
And you heard her ask them, if you would like to be treated the way our black American citizens are, please stand up. And nobody got up. So what she did in that, I thought it was one of the most profound examples of the fact that white people are not confused about racism. No matter what age range they are, because you can see if you look at the video, it's extremely short, but they scan the room and you can see that it's almost all ages of white people minus like elementary school age or high school age. So anybody in their early 20s through like elder stage, like maybe late 50s, early 60s was in that room. And to me, that's the question to ask white folks anywhere you are. Which of you white folks would love to be treated like like black people are treated, and see how many of them stand up and say, yes, I want to do that. You're going to see none every time. And to me, that just goes to show that collectively they are not confused about the system and what's happening. They just don't care, because as long as it's not them, then it's not a problem. Once it becomes them, then it becomes a problem. But what it is that they don't understand their own history in regards to Bacon's Rebellion and white people being invented in 1681. And the fact that the whole idea was to get poor whites on board with the idea that they were somehow better than non-white people. And that as long as they're not white, they're not non-white, that is the badge of honor that they've been duped into believing in. While financially they've been getting raped and robbed, just like the non-white people they're now bred to hate. So this kind of ties into another article, and I thank Dave for this one because he had it on the show, but he didn't really go into it, but I thought it was quite profound and it's super duper short. But it says here, this is from strategicculture.org, a record number of Americans no longer want to live in the U.S. So this is really short, so I'm going to run right through it. Anyone still calling America, quote unquote, the land of the free is delusional at best. Things continue to go from bad to worse in the United States, and people are feeling it. So much so that a record number of Americans no longer want to live in the United States at all. Once known as the land of opportunity, the U.S. is now more like the land of tax slave and debt slave. Unfortunately, it isn't the enslavement to debt or the government that is disturbing those the most. It's dissatisfaction with the current ruling class. According to Gallup, the recent poll they conducted showed that the 16% of Americans who said in 2017 and again in 2018 they would like to permanently move to another country if they could is higher than the average levels during either George W. Bush, 11%, or the Barack Obama administration, 10%. While Gallup poll does not ask people about their political leaning, most of the recent surge in Americans' desire to migrate has come among groups that typically lean Democratic and have disapproved of Trump's job performance so far in his presidency, women, young Americans, and people in the lower income groups. This is what Gallup says, which means that those people don't wish to be free. They simply want a different master somewhere else. And women appear to be angrier than men that their desired master isn't controlling them and their fellow slaves choose subservience to someone else. What's truly horrifying about this particular poll is that Americans, for all intents and purposes, have simply accepted the fact that they are required to be enslaved by the political elite. The 30% of Americans younger than 30 who would like to move also represents a new high, and it's also the group in which the gender gap is the largest. 40% of